The Allegheny Front is made possible in part by listeners like you. To add your support, please click donate at AlleghenyFront.org.
What's that? I can't hear you. There's a natural gas compressor station in my backyard. But some are stepping in to take the industry down a few decibels and ease tensions.
We help to ensure harmony between the industry and the community.
I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, the booming business of noise reduction. Climate change is catching up to your favorite sticky sweet pancake topper. And turkey vultures have faces only their mothers could love. But they get the spring cleaning done. All that and more is on the way, so please stay with us. The new leader of the State Department of Environmental Protection is defending Governor Tom Wolf's push for a new tax on gas drillers. At the State House budget hearing, acting DEP Secretary John Quigley faced criticism from legislators who said it's bad economic policy to tax an industry that's bringing in revenue and creating jobs. They're worried it will drive drillers out of Pennsylvania, but Quigley dismisses the notion.
This tax, as proposed by the governor, is not driving anybody anywhere. The industry will not leave the most productive resource on earth, because where would they go? To another state that already has a severance tax higher than what the government's proposed.
Wolf is proposing a 5% tax on drillers. He wants to spend most of the revenue on education. Quigley is also under fire for the Wolf administration's recent decision to disband an advisory committee that oversees oil and gas regulations. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports.
Shortly after dismissing the committee members, the DEP issued new, more stringent draft regulations for the oil and gas industry. At a House budget hearing, Republican Representative John Mayer of Allegheny County questioned DEP Acting Secretary John Quigley about who the new committee members are and whether they'll have time to review the new rules before an upcoming meeting.
And you've talked many times about integrity and transparency. What I've seen in this case doesn't exhibit either. We have a committee that's to meet on short notice about a voluminous document, and we don't even know who the committee members are.
Quigley later told reporters the makeup of the board was changed because a new law requires DEP to separate regulations for different types of drilling industries. Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.
As you heard, Quigley also made news this week by announcing a proposal to increase regulations on the oil and gas industry. Environmental groups are endorsing the Wolf administration's new rules, but the proposal is getting a cool response from the industry. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier digs into the rules and finds out what they might mean for the industry and communities living in the gas belt.
The proposed Wolf administration rules would do everything from limiting noise from fracking to increasing supervision of drilling near schools and better protecting groundwater and streams. But the biggest change probably has to do with how gas companies handle fracking wastewater. Companies that drill in the Marcellus and other deep shales would no longer be able to store waste in temporary storage pits. John Norbeck is acting president and CEO of the environmental group Penn Future.
Yeah, it's probably what I think most folks' eyes went to right away, is the elimination of the waste storage pits.
The question of what to do with wastewater from fracking has dogged the DEP since the gas boom began. Here's Deputy Secretary Scott Perry speaking last year.
Management of wastewater from oil and gas development is, in my opinion, the most critical environmental issue associated with the activity.
This is no small issue, in part because we're talking about a lot of waste. State records show gas wells produced nearly 2 billion gallons of wastewater in 2014. This wastewater contains chemicals used in hydraulic fracturing, metals, and salts that have made their way into the state's drinking water in the past. Most companies have moved away from using open-air storage pits at well sites in favor of storage tanks. Some use large centralized impoundments, big lined ponds that serve as waste stations for millions of gallons of drilling waste. In announcing the proposed rules this week, Perry said these too have been a big problem for the state.
These impoundments were only used by a small number of operators, but there have been compliance and pollution issues,
including as recently as last year, when the agency cited two companies for large leaks out of their storage facilities. So the agency is turning up the requirements for wastewater storage in these impoundments. According to the newly proposed rules, they'll need to be built to the same specifications as what the DEP requires for a landfill, like having thicker liners. Some companies are already storing their waste in impoundments that would meet these newer, tougher standards. For Norbeck of Penn Future, that means the new rules shouldn't be difficult for companies to comply with.
None of it's revolutionary. It's stuff that companies can do today if they so wanted to.
The gas industry might not see it this way. In an emailed statement, Marcellus Shale Coalition President Dave Spiegelmeyer called the proposed rules, quote, solutions in search of problems that threaten jobs. The DEP's acting secretary, however, John Quigley, thinks these rules were balanced and that they'll pave the way for what he calls responsible drilling.
And my definition of responsible drilling is protecting public health and the environment while enabling drilling to proceed.
The rules will get their first public airing this month, when a technical advisory board meets to discuss them. The DEP has a deadline to finalize the rules by spring of 2016. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
One novel aspect of the new oil and gas rules would limit noise coming from fracking operations. Nearby communities have complained about loud sounds from the fracking industry, and it's created somewhat of a boom for the anti-noise industry. From WCPN in Cleveland, Joanna Richards reports.
Carroll County in eastern Ohio was the original bird's eye for Utica shale gas development in the state. Trucks with Texas license plates now jam the roads alongside Amish buggies. Farmers are fixing up their houses as money from mineral leases rolls in. But for Frank Brothers, the price is too high.
As you can see, that's what's coming right at our door.
Even though their house sits on 21 forested acres, the Brothers family has been cooped up indoors with the windows closed since last March. That's when Blue Racer Midstream started the huge engines of its gas compressor station across the street. It's run pretty much 24/7 since. Brothers holds up a decibel meter at his front property line.
There you're hitting 87.
Compressors are needed about every 50 to 100 miles along pipelines to help move gas through them. They're always loud, but this situation is rare. Energy companies do usually shield the neighbors. And that's what's pushing what you might call a silent boom accompanying the oil and gas bonanza in noise abatement. Murray Stacy is VP of Shreveport-based Soundfighter Systems. He says the company got a ton of new business with development of the nearby Barnett Shale, underlying Fort Worth, Texas.
Noise became a front burner issue for them because the sweet spot of the shale was literally underneath some of the more densely populated areas.
At the peak of Barnett development, Stacy says 80% of Soundfighter's business came from the shale gas industry. It's still about 60%. The demand for noise control in the Utica and Marcellus shales drew Canadian company Noise Solutions to open a branch in western Pennsylvania.
It was a growth of about 100%.
Business development engineer Tyler Mose shows me what his company can do. He leads me outside to a little building designed for loud equipment. One side is open and another is walled off by a series of panels a few inches thick and about a foot and a half deep. From inside the building, it's like you're looking through open window blinds. The panels are made of perforated sheet metal and sound-absorbing insulation. Listen to how Moses' voice sounds standing next to me outside.
So this is a silencer for a cooler fan assembly that would be cooling the jacket water on a compressor driver.
Now listen to what he sounds like from inside the building, talking through the row of panels. So I can't hear him at all, really. I can watch his mouth moving, but I can't hear anything. I'm going to walk around. Tyler, could you just keep talking for a minute?
The noise that's produced from that inlet fan going to the driver.
That's impressive. That kind of technology can reduce compressor noise from this to this. That's from a compressor station like the one we heard earlier, blasting at the Brothers family's home. I taped the first clip inside the noise barrier building, and the second about 8 feet outside it. John Schnickenberg is principal engineer for Dominion East Ohio, which owns this station. He says the effect isn't cheap.
We're probably talking in excess of $250,000.
But that has bought much better relations with the neighbors. Even with low oil prices, professional noise fighters are confident. Sound regulations are tightening, and gas producers profit on volume, so they're always trying to move more gas faster. That means stronger and louder compressors. Noise Solutions CEO Scott McDonald says his role is to referee.
We help to ensure harmony between the industry and the community.
That doesn't guarantee communities will embrace oil and gas development, but it might lower the volume on a little part of the debate. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Joanna Richards in Cleveland.
In Looney Tunes cartoons, Beaky Buzzard is always scheming to land some food that's still alive, like Bugs Bunny.
My mama done told me bring home something for dinner.
For dinner? What's cooking?
But in real life, buzzards, or turkey vultures, eat from a buffet of rotting carcasses. The stinkier, the better. And they don't have great table manners either. So get a fork and knife ready. We're holding our nose and digging into an all-new Bird Files. That's later in the show. Phthalates are chemicals used to make plastic products pliable. They're found in food packaging, shampoos, and even baby products. Phthalates have also been fingered as endocrine disruptors, which means they affect hormones. One recent study in animals found that when mothers were exposed to phthalates during pregnancy, their babies had autistic characteristics. Research was also presented at this year's Endocrine Society annual meeting, which found that phthalates disrupted the masculinization of genitals in male fetuses. Jennifer Adibi is an assistant professor of epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh, and she's the author of that study. I visited her at her office in Pittsburgh to talk about her findings. Dr. Adibi, thanks for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
So your research looks at early pregnancy and how phthalates affect sex differentiation in fetuses and genital development. What did you find? What are your findings?
We found that the mother's concentrations in her urine of a very common chemical called phthalates was associated with levels in her blood of a pregnancy hormone called human chorionic gonadotropin. And the association actually differed depending on whether she was carrying a male baby or a female baby. So in the case of female babies, higher phthalates was associated with higher hormone level, and the male was the opposite.
The hormone that you're studying, that you mentioned, which is impacted by phthalates, is made by the placenta. Talk about that hormone and the role it plays in fetal development.
What we know is pretty much related to every physiologic process in pregnancy, and with respect to the baby's development, the fetal development, there's less known, although it has been shown that HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin, does bind to a receptor in the male fetal testis that is essential for initiating production of the male hormone, testosterone. And testosterone is required for normal male development.
I'm using the word sex differentiation like everyone knows what that means. What does sex differentiation mean?
In my mind, it means really those early points in human development when boys become boys and girls become girls. And we don't totally understand how that happens. We think a lot of it's genetic, you know, presence or absence of a Y chromosome, in the case of a male. We're learning more and more that there are a lot of non-X and Y linked factors that also determine maleness and femaleness. So I think our general curiosity is how those types of factors are disrupted by the environment, and could we be seen on a population level, kind of loss of some of that normal sex differentiation.
So how would this manifest itself in fetal health and in the health of the fetuses who go on to become boys?
Well, so that is, I think, where we're just starting to move towards. There are, in the rodents, very well worked out experimental models where if you give the pregnant mother the phthalate, you get a whole constellation of effects in the males related to testicular development. So lower testosterone, certainly, malformations in the genitalia. Over the life of that male, there'll be lower sperm count, lower fertility, eventually maybe higher risk of testicular cancers. In the human, we don't know if this is true, and there's a lot of people trying to work this out. But we do know that lower AGD, or anogenital distance, which is the measure we took in the newborns at birth, it's the measure from the anus to the bottom of the genitalia, both in the male and the female, scrotum to anus and fourchette to anus, is correlated with reproductive health and function of that child as he or she goes through life.
This is an adverse effect that phthalates are having on fetal development.
We would need to know how those babies are different given their shorter, say, anogenital distance at birth. We don't know that for sure. I think what the strength of this study is that we're getting our first real signal that there's a physiologic thing, you know, a biologic endpoint we can measure early in pregnancy that is correlated with these exposures, which means we can focus, kind of shine the light earlier in pregnancy in terms of how the placenta and the fetus are responding to environmental exposures and also how that might be related to the health of the baby long term.
So where do your findings fit in with what's already known about health impacts of phthalates and endocrine disruptors?
I think where we come in is trying to identify and characterize the role of the placenta. The placenta is this major and fascinating organ that's basically produced by the fetus. Without placenta, you don't get life. It's carrying out all kinds of functions essential for the pregnancy and for the baby's development, yet it is often overlooked.
How could these findings impact testing or treatment or care of pregnant women by their doctors?
That's the million-dollar question. I would say the research is not there in terms of a clinical translation, but the long-term vision is that, you know, can we collect more data, and using that data, we can then understand what might be cutoffs for defining normal and abnormal, use that at a clinical level, an individual level, to then think of ways to intervene.
Where are phthalates found? Are there products that women are using, especially in pregnancy, that contain phthalates?
Not especially. I would say they're just everywhere, to the point where a lot of us just throw up our hands, because you can shop at Whole Foods every day and do your best to eliminate your phthalates, but they're generally still going to show up in your urine. I think that the take-home message really is more to the makers of the products, to the government regulatory agencies. Like, how can we as a society think about these exposures, and do we want to endure these risks, and are there options, maybe potential for innovation, to think of maybe still having our plastics, but better, safer plastics that are not going to harm our fetuses?
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Dr. Jennifer Adibi. She's an assistant professor of epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh. You can find more about the study on our website, alleghenyfront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Just in time for St. Patrick's Day celebrations, there's good news about beer and climate change. A group of 24 brewers from across the country has signed a climate declaration. It's an agreement to cut greenhouse gas emissions from their operations and a call for a strong national action to address climate change. The breweries include Smutty Nose Brewing and Guinness. They admit their industry uses a lot of energy in heating, cooling, and transportation. The brewers say they're working to reduce those impacts, and at the same time, they're concerned that climate change is bringing an increase in severe droughts around the world, and that could harm the quality of barley and hops, leaving their brews flat. And climate change might impact another tasty, if non-alcoholic, product. The cold Northeast winter has made maple syrup producers heading out into the sugar bush a little later than last year. But in the long term, rising temperatures could tap out the Northeastern maple industry. Federal climate models have predicted the region will lose most of its maples by next century. Right now, producers don't seem worried. Maple syrup prices are high, and with technology, the sap is flowing just fine. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
Jason Blotcher's livelihood each year largely depends on the weather in February and March. He's the third generation in his family to run Milroy Maple Farms in Somerset County on Pennsylvania's southern border, just a few miles from Maryland.
You can't outguess Mother Nature, and she controls everything in this business.
It takes warm days and cold nights to get sap flowing through a sugar maple. They start drilling tap holes in the trees when daytime temperatures get in the 40s and nights are still below freezing. When Blotcher was a kid, they would tap in late February and early March. But he says that's changed in the past 10 years. Now they usually tap earlier, as much as a month earlier, and the timing is more erratic. Like most producers, Blotcher remembers the winter of 2012 when there was a thick layer of snow in his maple forest. And then, right as syruping was starting, temperatures shot up into the 80s. It was the warmest March on record.
So we went from fighting our way through 3 or 4 feet of snow in anticipation of a very good season because of that heavy snowpack to one of our poorest seasons we have on record because we had such a drastic change in the weather from cold, deep snow to too warm in that, you know, in a matter of 2 weeks to 3 weeks, it ruined our season.
Milroy Farms wasn't alone. U.S. syrup production was down as much as 40% in 2012. Erratic years like that aren't a surprise to Dave Cleaves. He's the climate change advisor at the U.S. Forest Service, which means he's often the bearer of bad news.
God, in this job I'm in, and people like this, they hate to see me coming, you know. They run like hell.
About 15 years ago, the Forest Service published what's called the Climate Change Tree Atlas, and what it found didn't look good for sugar maples in the Northeast.
We will see it gradually disappear or become less prominent.
Cleve says southern Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Maryland are on the southern edge of large-scale maple syrup production. He says as the climate changes, they're the first places that will have troubles with maple trees.
Because there are other more aggressive and adapted southern species that are always there, ready to take off and regenerate.
Milroy Farms owner Jason Blotcher says his maple grove grows along Mount Davis, the highest point in Pennsylvania, which gives trees the colder temperatures they like. So he doesn't get too worked up about climate change.
Oh, you hear about that all the time, you know, and the global warming. But I think that sugar maple is a very hardy tree and very adaptable. So I think under slight changes and so forth, it'll adapt.
And some of the top maple syrup researchers in Vermont and New York agree with him. Temperatures in the Northeast already have risen an average of 2 degrees Fahrenheit since 1970. And they say maple syrup production is going gangbusters. Blotcher is like most producers these days. He uses vacuum tubing to pull sap from the maple trees. This, coupled with other technologies, allows him to double production in half the time it took his parents. Michael Farrell is a maple syrup expert at Cornell University, and he runs a sugar bush in northern New York. In his book, The Sugarmaker's Companion, he says newer forest models, which take factors other than climate into account, show that things don't look as bad as the Forest Service predictions. Farrell says his own PhD research, looking at maple trees in the forest mix, backs that up.
We're not getting replaced by oaks and hickories up here in the Northeast. It's very unlikely that that's going to happen. And, you know, the foresters down in the mid-Atlantic, Midwest, where there's a lot of oak and hickory, you know, they're concerned that they're not getting the regeneration of oak and hickory. And they consider, a lot of them consider sugar and red maple invasive species down there.
But that's not what the Forest Service is seeing in the long term, 85 years from now, in the time frame of a tree's life. Dave Cleaves says maple producers and researchers may be experiencing good times now. Trees aren't falling over and dying. But Forest Service studies that look at changes in the woodlands every few years don't find many maple saplings in the Northeast.
When they actually get down on the ground and count the seedlings by species, then they get an idea of, well, what is this future forest likely to look like? Because we're looking at the babies here.
Cornell researcher Michael Farrell says the biggest danger to young sugar maples is deer, which can eat the saplings. And syrup producers like Jason Blotcher are more concerned about invasive insects like the Asian longhorn beetle than warming temperatures. But the Forest Service's Dave Cleaves says problems like these are intertwined with climate change.
It's not just the changing climate itself that impacts. It works through these stressors that are already there. Say it's moisture stress on the forest if it gets too dry, or if it gets wetter and moister, and that's more conducive to insect and disease proliferation, then it's working through insect and disease.
At Milroy Farms, Jason Blotcher says there's nothing he can do about global warming, so he doesn't worry about it. But some forest researchers go so far as to call the maple tree a poster child for climate change in the Northeast because they say it's a resilient tree that might not make it unless efforts to cut greenhouse gases take root. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
I can't look at the rocket launch, the trophy wives of the astronauts, and I won't listen to their words, 'cause I like birds.
It's finally happening. After a long winter, many of us are waking up to an increasing number of chirps and tweets. Spring and spring migration is in the air. Early spring is also when nature's cleanup crew returns from its winter vacation. Turkey vultures are among those on the move, and they're arriving just in time to take care of the defrosting carcasses that have been frozen over the winter. For the Allegheny Front's Bird Files, Kate St. John explains.
Turkey vultures, sometimes called buzzards, are large, dark, hawk-like birds with long, broad wings that often soar in groups. Vultures may have a bad name, especially to the uninformed, because they eat rotted meat. The smellier, the better. Circling overhead, they can smell a carcass hidden by trees. Once found, a wake of vultures soon gathers for the feast. This is the only time you may hear them. They're quiet, except when they're fighting over food. Turkey vultures are good at finding bad odors like the rotten egg smell of natural gas. Energy companies out west used to watch where vultures congregated to locate leaks in their pipelines. Vultures' eating habits are helpful too. They can devour anthrax-infected animals because their powerful stomachs protect them. When the vulture cleanup crew eats a carcass, they remove dangerous toxins from the environment, saving the rest of us from exposure to really dangerous stuff. But even vultures have limits. They can't eat frozen food. So turkey vultures travel south in the fall for warmer climes. On peak days in October, 150,000 of them can pass the Veracruz Hawk Watch on Mexico's Gulf Coast. They fly back in March when their breeding instincts kick in. Look for them overhead now, but it will take some observation to tell them apart from hawks or eagles. There are two big clues to help you out. Turkey vultures soar with their wings held in a shallow V called a dihedral, and they teeter side to side in the air. They hold their wings stiff, rarely flapping, and rock from side to side to make course corrections. So if you see a large, dark, hawk-like bird making lazy circles in the sky, look for the teetering and its wings held in a shallow V. The V is for vulture. For the Allegheny Front Bird Files, I'm Kate St. John.
Those ghastly hisses of turkey vultures were provided by the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Thanks so much for that. You can find a link to Kate St. John's birding blog, Outside My Window, at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. And connect with Bird Files and lots of other bird news on Twitter, at AFBirds. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. Julie Grant's our managing editor. I'm Kara Holsoppel. You can follow me on Twitter at AfrontKara and find out more about our stories and even more environmental news at Allegheny Front. Join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, and the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.